Welcome to Nightlife, bite-sized travel.
50 years ago, this September, the QE2 cruise ship was launched at Southampton. And as it turned out, it was the last liner to be built in Britain. It went on to become the longest-serving ocean cruise ship in history and the most travelled. Chris Frame is a cruise historian who's so well-versed in all things QE2 that he's being flown to the UK next month to be the keynote speaker on commemorative cruises on the new Queen Elizabeth. And he joins us now. Chris, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Thank you.
The launch really does go back to the dying days of British liner building industry, doesn't it? Where was the QE2 built?
So she was built in Clydebank in Scotland, and that was a very famous place that had built many, many ocean liners since the dawn of the ocean liner back in the 1800s. And the QE2 was the last big passenger ship contract that they had there. So it was an extremely emotional day when the ship was launched, because many people who had sort of had a family history of working in the shipyards there kind of knew that that was their last major build. So off she went down the slipway, and with that, it came to an end, the era of the ocean liner.
Well, yeah, I suppose the era of the ocean liner didn't come to an end, did it? But being built there, it did. I mean, these days, they're all built where?
So today, most of the cruise ships are built in places in Italy. There's a big shipyard called Fincantieri. There's also shipyards in France and in Finland. But when I say the era of the ocean liner, I mean ships that were designed to undertake those ocean voyages between point A and point B over a large expanse of ocean, of which QE2 was the last, until Queen Mary 2 in 2004. She was the last one built for that purpose on the North Atlantic. Cruise ships are a little bit different. They have a purpose to undertake pleasure voyages. They don't usually transit large bodies of water as a method of taking people from point A to point B as a journey. It's more of a holiday and more of a relaxing pleasure voyage, whereas QE2 was built to sort of do both, and that's what made her special, but it also allowed her to survive because she could do both the transatlantic and also operate as a cruise ship.
Oh, okay. I didn't understand the distinction, but I'm glad you explained it.
That's okay. It's one of the most regular questions I get when I speak on the passenger ships, because people don't really realise, I don't think.
Yeah, because I was wondering why, in that sense, the Scottish shipyards didn't keep building them, because, as you say, the Europeans build them now, so it can't just be a cost thing.
Yeah, no, what happened really was as jet aircraft became more and more popular as a way to travel, so sort of the Boeing 707 really started all this in 1958, and it just became so much more commonplace for people to travel a long distances by air. That resulted in ocean liners as a mode of transport really coming to an end. And there was a bit of a gap between the ocean liners ending and cruising really taking off as a pleasure voyage. So shipyards like those in Scotland that have been building these ocean liners, by the time the cruising became popular enough to have a big sort of influx of people building ships, new ships being built, they'd really, a lot of them had lost the skill and the ability to do that sort of thing, and they just couldn't get back in the game the way that the European shipyards were able to.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. When I think about it now, if I wanted to go from Sydney to London on a ship, I don't think you can. Probably, can you?
No. Well, only maybe if you caught a cruise ship that was doing the world voyage, and you could probably get back to Europe that way.
Sort of, yeah.
A long, long voyage. It's quite remarkable, really.
How grand was she back in the day when she was brand new? I mean, was she cutting edge, or was she a legacy ship even when she was launched?
So the QE2 was actually remarkably different to anything that she replaced when she first came into service. So she entered service in 1969, having been launched in 1967, and it took those 2 years to sort of fit her out and deck her out on the inside. She had a very 1960s style interior, so everything was ultra-modern. It was glass and chrome and fiberglass fittings, and very different from the sort of the dowdy image of the Art Deco ocean liner that they were trying to escape from. They made a realization during the construction period that if QE2 was going to survive, she really had to be a cut above the rest, something completely different, new and trendy, and attract a new breed of passenger. And so they were very successful. I mean, the critics just hated the ship. There were negative reviews in all of the major papers, but the travelling public fell in love with her, and she really attracted a new group of travellers who had never really been attracted to the sea before.
Why was that? What do you think that was?
It was this sort of, I guess, the trendy feeling about the ship, the fact that she was designed to be a floating resort, really. So she had all sorts of amenities that had never really been seen on transatlantic liners before. She was designed to undertake cruising as well. So even when you were doing the crossings, you had all these amenities like indoor swimming pools and outdoor swimming pools and Lido decks and places mm-hmm. to relax and you know, very 60s inspired rooms and public spaces on board, so nightclubs and that sort of thing, which brought a younger group of travellers onto the ship to experience it more as a holiday than it was than it was, I guess, a sort of mode of transport.
Yeah, was she always expensive? I mean, these days cruising's become quite competitive in terms of price. I mean, even people of modest incomes can get on a cruise these days. But the QE2 was always top draw, wasn't she?
Well, the QE2 was interesting because she had that reputation as being like a really expensive way to travel. But what they did on the QE2 is they actually broke the ship down into, so by the time it retired, it was one class. When it first came into service, it was a two-class ship on the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. But what they really did is they had a series of different kinds of restaurants, which were paired with the cabin category that you paid for. Mm-hmm. So if you were paying top dollar, you would have a very large suite, you'd have a butler service, you'd be eating in one of the finest restaurants in the world. In fact, the Queen's Grill restaurant on the ship was repetitively rated as one of the world's best restaurants. And that was obviously very expensive. But you could also get a small inside cabin with no view and access to a very nice but not anywhere near as fancy restaurant and still enjoy all the amenities of the ship. And that was a relatively modest price. Mm. And so QE2 was sort of like a ship that had multiple different classes within her. And that gave her the ability to carry people from all different walks of life.
Yeah. I'm talking with Chris Frayne. He's a cruise historian. We're talking about the QE2. Which was launched 50 years ago in September, the last cruise liner to be built in Britain. Was she a financial success, Chris? Did she make money for the owners? Because the Cunard line must have taken a bit of a gamble on this, did they?
They did. They bet the house. They bet everything. I mean, Cunard had to mortgage 11 of its ships to pay for QE2. They had to take out millions of pounds in loans from the British government, who by that stage weren't very keen to be investing in what they thought might potentially be a failed venture with a passenger ship. And I think it was interesting because Cunard had originally looked at other designs for a classic liner that was multiple classes and very large and wasn't able to go cruising easily. Mm. And then they realized there was a sort of a light bulb moment, I suppose, that if they were going to survive, they really had to build a ship that was very versatile and could do all different types of itineraries. And within her first season, she was making enough money for them to repay some of their government loan. Of course, there was moments in the career of the ship where it got a little bit worrying. I mean, with the oil crisis, for example, in the 70s, things were getting very expensive to run a very big ship. But then in the 1980s, they re-engined her with diesel engines, and she was always a very pleasing ship for them financially. They kept her in service for 39 and a half years and spent more than 10 times the building cost on her in refurbishing her. So that kind of gives you an indication as to how much money they must have been getting back from her if they could afford to do that. Yeah,
if they could afford to do that, they must have made a lot of money out of it. Exactly. Yeah. Was she when she was launched, she was the biggest liner in the world, wasn't she?
QE2 was never the biggest liner in the world, although when she was in service, she was one of the biggest that was left because many of the big ships were retiring at that stage. But that is one of the reasons why she was successful, because she was smaller than the very big liners, the Queen Elizabeth and the Queen Mary, for example, the two original queens. Mm-hmm. She was then able to transit the Panama Canal. And by being able to transit the Panama Canal, she could go on world cruises, which meant that during the winter months in the Northern Hemisphere, she could escape the winter and come down into the Southern Hemisphere and sort of follow the sun, which meant that, you know, in the age of the jet, where people didn't want to be on an ocean liner in the middle of a storm in the Atlantic in winter, the ship would have been sailing empty. But because she could go cruising and come down to places like Australia and New Zealand and in the Pacific as well and into tropical areas, she was able to make money year round. And that's what actually kept her from becoming a financial disaster.
Mm. Yeah, she's had a bit of a history though, hasn't she? She was commandeered by the Defence Force in the Falklands War, wasn't she? And used as a troop carrier to get troops down to the Falklands.
She was, yeah. So like so many British ships before her, she was requisitioned in time of war. In fact, her sister ships, Elizabeth and Mary, had been used during World War II. Previous Cunard ships had been used in World War I. In fact, some of them carried the Anzacs. So there's a long history of requisitioning ships. And when the Falklands War occurred, the Canberra is a P&O ship named after the capital of Australia. It was requisitioned first and sent into the thick of the war zone. And then just a little while later, QE2 was requisitioned and given a very quick, very extensive refit where they basically stripped out the interiors, put down wooden planking and metal and sort of reinforced the ship to allow it to carry 3,000 troops, rearranged all the restaurants so that people could be fed, cut off the aft deck so they could carry helicopters on board. So she basically became a helicopter carrier. And she was sent down to the South Atlantic. But unlike the Canberra, which was sent into the thick of the war zone, QE2, with the name of the Queen, it was felt that she was a very valuable target in terms of, you know, the propaganda that would have happened if a QE2 had been damaged or sunk, and the morale blow that it would have affected on the British public. And so she was kept relatively safe. I wouldn't say she was safe, but she wasn't sent into the thick of the war zone. And in fact, her troops were transferred to the Canberra for the last bit of the journey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, she came to Australia 32 times. I remember going on her once, not traveling, we just got on her in when she was anchored in Sydney Harbour and met a woman who lived on her.
Yes, that's true.
Some people actually had bought a cabin and that was their home.
That was, yeah. The longest, there was one lady who lived on board for a decade on the ship. Yeah. And also in the 90s, there were some people who lived on extended stays on board the ship, one of which didn't want her cabin touched when the ship went in for refit. They were that particular about the way that their room was set up. So, yeah, it's quite a remarkable thing. It's an alternative to retirement villages, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there are plenty of people who predicted that the grand old days of cruising were over once cheap air travel came in, but it hasn't proved to be the case. Cruising's on a growth curve at the moment. But the QE2, of course, she was retired back in 2008. What led to that?
So QE2 was approaching its 40th year in service, and you know, as a ship ages, it's a very expensive undertaking to keep the ship operating. She'd been given a full re-engining, so they took out her old steam turbine plant in 1986 and installed diesel engines into the ship, and she went back into service in 87. So the engines were in relatively good condition, the hull was in good condition, but it's all the other things, the auxiliary services, the plumbing, the piping, the wiring, the cabling, and the fact that the ship's interior you know, was built in the 1960s, it was sort of starting to get a little bit worn out.
Yeah.
And so she was sold to Dubai for $100 million with the hope to be turned into a floating hotel on the Palm Jumeirah Island. And at the time, that seemed like a really positive end for the ship, because rather than her continuing on for a few more years and then maybe being sold for scrap like so many ships are, she looked like she was going to have a positive future as a tourist attraction.
But that hasn't happened.
It hasn't, no. So unfortunately for QE2, it seems that she's become a victim of the global financial crisis, and the ship has been laid up. Firstly, it was a warm layup, so they kept her engine running for the first few years, and she was still manned by a seagoing crew, so she was technically still able to sail. And in recent years, she's been in cold layup, so they've switched her all off and sort of closed her up, and we're not too sure exactly what's going to happen to her in the future.
She's going to go for scrap, isn't she, by the sound of it?
Yeah, well, I guess the longer she sits there, the less hope there is around the world that she's going to end up being opened. Yeah.
Yeah. They won't build another one, will they, or will they?
Well, they built the Queen Mary too.
I was going to say, the Queen Mary was built, yeah.
Yeah, she was, yeah. So she was built, came into service in 2004. Now, she's quite different to QE2 in that she was built as a, similar to QE2, she was built as a transatlantic liner that could also undertake pleasure voyages, but she's much bigger. And they overcome the cruising issue that QE2 was built for because of, you know, changes in technology. So Queen Mary 2 is a lot more manoeuvrable. She's got potted propulsion. She has the same draft, which is the amount of ship that sits under the waterline as QE2, because technologies have improved and they can build the ships to those sort of standards. And so she can actually undertake many of the voyages that QE2 did. And she is at the moment the last active transatlantic ocean liner. Whether or not they build a replacement for Queen Mary 2, I guess for most of QE2's career, they thought she was the last. So I wouldn't say that Queen Mary 2 is the last, because we probably get proved wrong again. But she's got another 30 years left in her yet. So yeah, it'd be a while off.
Fascinating time. All right, Chris, enjoy the commemorative cruise that you'll be lecturing on.
Thank you very much.
Some wonderful memories. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.